This is disc number 6.
Gabriel cast a desultory glance at his wristwatch. You're wasting time. But then, maybe that's your plan. You think you can hold out until the deadline expires. 4 days is a very long time to hold out, Ibrahim. It cannot be done. Start talking, Ibrahim. Confess. I have nothing to confess. His words were spoken with little conviction. Gabriel pressed his advantage. Tell me everything you know, Ibrahim, or the Americans will take over. And if the Americans don't get the information they want from you using their methods, they're going to put you on a plane to Egypt and let the SSI take over the questioning. He looked at the burn marks on the Egyptian's arms. You know all about their methods, don't you, Ibrahim? The cigarettes were the kindest thing they did to me. Rest assured that nothing you say frightens me. I don't believe there are any Americans, and I don't believe anyone's going to send me to Egypt to be interrogated. I am a citizen of the Netherlands. I have my rights. Gabriel leaned back in his chair and thumped the side of his fist twice against the double doors. A moment later, Sarah was standing at his side and staring unabashedly at Ibrahim, who averted his gaze in shame and squirmed anxiously in his chair.
Good evening, Mr. Fawaz. My name is Catherine Blanchard, and I am an employee of the Central Intelligence Agency. 1 mile from here, there's a plane fueled and waiting to take you to Cairo. If you have any further questions, I'll be right outside the door.
Sarah left the room and closed the doors behind her. Ibrahim glared at Gabriel in anger.
How dare you let that woman see me like this? Next time you won't doubt my word.
The Egyptian looked down at the file.
What does it say about me?
It says you are one of the original members of the First Sword of Allah, Selin Minya. It says you were a close associate of Sheikh Tayeb Abul Razak and his brother, Sheikh Abdullah. It says you organized a terrorist cell at the University of Minya and recruited a number of young students to the radical Islamist cause. It says you wanted to bring down the regime and replace it with an Islamic state.
Guilty on all counts, said Ibrahim. All but one very important count. There was indeed a sword cell at the university, but it had nothing to do with terrorism. The sword of Allah turned to terror only after Sadat's assassination, not before.
He looked down at the file again.
What else does it say?
It says you were arrested the night of Sadat's murder.
And?
That's the last entry.
That's hardly surprising. What happened after my arrest is not something they would want to put down on paper.
Ibrahim looked up from the file.
Would you like to know what happened to me that night? Would you like me to fill in the missing pages of that file you wave in front of me as though it were proof of my guilt?
You have 30 minutes to tell me the truth, Ibrahim. You may use them any way you wish.
I wish to tell you a story, my friend. The story of a man who lost everything because of his beliefs.
I'm listening.
May I have some coffee?
No.
Will you at least remove the handcuffs?
No.
My arms hurt terribly.
Too bad. He had been a professor once, and spoke like one now. He started his account not with the story of a man, but with the struggle of a generation. A generation that had been raised to believe in secularisms, Nasserism, Baathism, communism, Pan-Arabism, Arab socialism, only to learn in June 1967 that all the isms were merely a mask for Arab weakness and decay.
You are the ones who unleashed the storm, he said.
The Palestinians had their catastrophe in 48. For us, it was 67. 6 days in June that shook the Arab world to its core. We had been told by Nasser and the secularists that we were mighty. Then you Jews proved in a matter of hours that we were nothing. We went in search of answers. Our search led us home again, back to Islam. You were in the army in 67.
He shook his head. I'd done my army service already. I was at Cairo University in 67, within weeks of the war ending. We organized an illegal Islamist cell there. I was one of its leaders until 1969, when I completed my doctorate in economics. Upon graduation, I had two choices. Go to work as a bureaucrat in Pharaoh's bureaucracy, or take a job teaching in Pharaoh's schools. I chose the latter, and accepted a position at the University of Minya in Middle Egypt. 6 months later, Nasser was dead. And everything changed, said Gabriel. Almost overnight, Ibrahim said in agreement. Sadat encouraged us. He granted us freedom and money to organize. We grew our beards, we established youth organizations and charities to help the poor. We did paramilitary training at desert camps funded by the government and Sadat's wealthy patrons. We lived our lives according to God's law, and we wanted God's laws to be the laws of Egypt. Sadat promised us that he would institute Sharia. He broke his promise, and then he compounded his sins by signing a peace treaty with the devil, and for that he paid with his life. You approved of Sadat's assassination? I fell to my knees and thanked God for striking him down. And then the roundups began. Almost immediately, Ibrahim said. The state feared that Sadat's death was only the opening shot of an Islamic revolution that was about to sweep the country. They were wrong, of course, but that didn't stop them from using the mailed fist against anyone whom they believed was part of the conspiracy or conspiracies to come. They came for you at the university. He shook his head. I left the university at sundown and went home to my apartment. When I arrived, no one was there. I asked the neighbors if they had seen my wife and children. They told me they'd been taken into custody. I went to the police station, but they weren't there, and the police said there was no record of their arrest. Then I went to the Minya headquarters of the SSI. His voice trailed off, and he looked down at the file in front of him. Do you know about the bridge over Jahannam, my friend? It is the bridge all Muslims must cross in order to reach paradise. Narrower than a spider web, and sharper than a sword, Gabriel said. The good cross swiftly and are rewarded, but the wicked lose their footing and are plunged into the fires of hell. Ibrahim looked up from the file, clearly impressed by Gabriel's knowledge of Islam. I'm one of the unfortunate few who's actually seen the bridge over Jahannam, he said. I was made to walk it that night in October 1981, and I'm afraid I lost my footing. Gabriel removed Ibrahim's handcuffs and told him to keep talking. He was taken to a cell and beaten mercilessly for 12 hours. When the beatings finally ceased, he was brought to an interrogation room and placed before a senior SSI man, who ordered him to reveal everything he knew about planned Islamist terror operations in the Minya region. He answered the question truthfully, that he knew of no plans for any attacks, and was immediately returned to the cell, where he was beaten on and off for several days. Again he was brought before the senior officer, and again he denied knowledge of future attacks. This time, the SSI man led him to a different cell, where an adolescent girl, naked and unconscious, hung by her hands from a hook in the ceiling. She had been flogged and slashed to ribbons with a razor, and her face was distorted by swelling and bleeding. It took Ibrahim a moment to realize that the young girl was his daughter, Jihan. They revived her with several buckets of cold water, he said. She looked at me, and for a moment didn't recognize me either. The senior man whipped her savagely for several minutes. Then the others took her down from the hook and raped her in front of me. My daughter looked at me while she was being mauled by these animals. She pleaded with me to help her. Please, Papa, she said. Tell them what they want to know. Make them stop. But I couldn't make them stop. I didn't have anything to tell them. He began to shiver violently. May I have my clothing now? Keep talking, Ibrahim. He lapsed into a long silence. For a moment, Gabriel feared he had lost him, but eventually, after another spasm of trembling, he began to speak again. They placed me in the cell next door, so that I was forced to endure the screams of my daughter all through that long night. When I was brought before the senior officer for a third time, I told him anything I could think of to ease her suffering. I gave him crumbs from my table, but then crumbs were all I had to give. I gave him the names of other sword members. I gave him the addresses of apartments where we had met. I gave him the names of students at the university who I believed might be involved in radical activities. I told him what he wanted to hear, even though I knew I was condemning innocent friends and colleagues to the same suffering I had endured. He seemed satisfied with my confession. Even so, I was given one more beating that night. When it was over, I was tossed into a cell and left for dead. For the first time, I was not alone. There was another prisoner there.
You recognized him? Gabriel asked.
Eventually.
Who was it?
It was Sheikh Abdullah. He recited the words of the Prophet to me. Rely on God. Don't be defeated. He soothed my wounds and prayed over me for the next 2 days. I am alive because of him.
And your daughter?
Ibrahim glanced at Gabriel's wristwatch. How much time do I have left before I am handed over to the Americans? Gabriel removed the watch and slipped it into his jacket pocket. May I have my clothing now? Gabriel leaned back in his chair and hammered twice on the double doors.
Chapter 26. Norfolk, England. 10:34 p.m. Monday. The same bright moon that hung over the plains of northern Germany was visible in the skies above the Norfolk coast that evening as Marcia Cromwell, an unmarried woman of 36, headed down the sandy pathway to the beach at Walcott with Ginger, her Welsh Springer Spaniel, following closely at her heels. Questions about the morality of torture, or even the fate of the missing American woman, were of no concern to her at that moment. She had just been informed by her latest lover that, after much deliberation, he had decided not to leave his wife and children for her after all. Marcia Cromwell, a lifelong resident of Norfolk, had decided to deal with the pain the same way she had dealt with every other setback, by taking a late-night walk along the North Sea. At the end of the pathway, the beach opened suddenly before her, flat and seemingly limitless in the darkness, with wind-driven waves breaking in a phosphorus arc along the crest of hard, dark sand. Ginger was behaving oddly. Usually he was straining at his leash at this point, anxious to be let loose on the beach so he could torment the gulls and sandpipers. Now he was sitting warily at her feet, peering intently into the grove of pine trees at the base of the dunes. Marcia Cromwell removed his leash and encouraged him to head down to the water's edge. Instead, he immediately trotted off into the trees. Marcia Cromwell hesitated before going after him. The police had recently uncovered an encampment of vagrant travelers there, and the trees were always strewn with empty beer cans and litter. She called out to Ginger several times, then removed a flashlight from her coat pocket and went in search of him. She spotted him a moment later, pawing at something on the ground at the base of one of the trees. Marcia Cromwell walked over to investigate. Then she began to scream. The discovery of a corpse on the beach at Walcott immediately triggered activation of the Norfolk Constabulary's Major Investigation Team, established in September 2004 to conduct probes into crimes such as homicide, manslaughter, and rape. Each team consists of a senior investigating officer, his deputy, an exhibits officer who processes crime scene evidence, and an inquiry officer who interviews witnesses and suspects. Within 30 minutes of receiving Marcia Cromwell's call, all four officers were on the scene. Only two, the SIO and the exhibits officer, entered the trees at the base of the dunes. They wore yellow protective shoe covers in order to preserve any forensic evidence and examined the corpse by flashlight.
"How long has he been here?" asked the SIO.
"Between 48 and 72 hours, I'd say."
"Preliminary cause of death?"
"Single gunshot wound to the back of the head. Execution style by the looks of it. But here's the interesting thing." The crime scene analyst shone a small maglite at the lower right leg of the corpse.
"A splint?"
"Quite a good one, actually. But look at the wound. The coroner will have to make the final determination, but I'm willing to wager it was caused by a bullet."
"Caliber?"
"Looks like a 9mm to me, but that's not the interesting part. It's several days older than the head wound, and whoever treated it knew exactly what she was doing."
"She?"
"Elizabeth Halton is an emergency room surgeon from Denver, Colorado. I could be wrong,
but I think this corpse could well be one of the terrorists from Hyde Park. Didn't Cobra and the Home Office tell us to be on the lookout for unexplained bullet wounds?
Yes, they did, the SIO said.
The wound and surrounding tissue exhibit signs of severe infection. I'd say our man was wounded by that Israeli chap during the actual kidnapping. His comrades tried to keep him alive, but apparently they finally gave up and put him out of his misery with a neat bullet in the back of the head. He probably suffered terribly. I suppose there is some justice in the world after all.
SIO crouched next to the body and examined the lower leg of the corpse, then began searching the corpse itself for evidence. The coat pockets were empty, as were the front pockets of his trousers, but in the back right pocket he found a single sheet of paper, folded in quarters and flattened by many days of pressure. The SIO unfolded it carefully and read it by the beam of his flashlight.
Draw me up a list of supplies one would need to treat a bullet wound in the field, things that can be purchased over the counter at an ordinary chemist's shop, and put a very wide cordon around this scene. If your theory about this chap is correct, this beach is going to be invaded soon by several hundred men from the anti-terrorist branch, MI5, the FBI, and the CIA.
Done.
The SIO turned and walked quickly out of the trees. 2 minutes later, he was behind the wheel of his car, speaking by radio to the duty officer in the Operations and Communications Center.
It looks like the body might be linked to the missing American woman, he said. Get the chief constable on the phone immediately, and bring him into the picture.
Anything else, sir?
I found a receipt in his pocket for the Portsmouth to Le Havre ferry. If this chap is really one of the terrorists, it could mean that the American girl is now in France.
The series of events that occurred next unfolded with precision and remarkable swiftness. The Operations and Communications Center immediately located the Norfolk Chief Constable, who was dining with friends and family in Norwich, and told him of the discovery. The Chief Constable stepped away from the table and quietly relayed the information to his superiors at the Home Office, who in turn informed the Cobra Committee and the Police Nationale of France. 15 minutes after the SIO's initial dispatch from the beach, news of the discoveries reached the American team at Grosvenor Square. A secure cable was sent priority status from the embassy to all federal agencies involved in the search for Elizabeth Halton, including the CIA. At 6:18 p.m. Eastern Time, a copy reached the hands of Adrian Carter, who at that moment was seated in his regular chair in the CIA's Global Ops Center, monitoring a highly illegal clandestine interrogation now taking place at a derelict farmhouse in the plains of northern Germany. He read the note quickly, and for the first time in more than a week felt a fleeting sense of hope. Then he set the cable aside and stared at his monitor. The feed had been silent for 5 minutes. Gabriel, it seemed, had taken a break for dinner. Chapter 27. Northern Germany. 12:36 a.m., Tuesday. They brought his clothing. Then they brought him food, rice and beans, hard-boiled eggs and feta cheese, flatbread and sweet tea. He took a single bite, then pushed the plate a few inches toward Gabriel. Gabriel refused at first, but Ibrahim insisted. And so they sat there for several moments, prisoner and interrogator, sharing a simple meal in silence.
We Muslims have a tradition called Eid, Ibrahim said. If a sheep is to be slaughtered, it is given one final meal.
He looked up from his food at Gabriel.
Is that what you are doing now, my friend? Giving your sacrificial lamb one final taste of life?
How long did they hold you? Gabriel asked.
6 months, said Ibrahim. And my release was as undignified as my arrest and incarceration. They turned me onto the streets of Minya in rags and ordered me to go home. When I entered my apartment, my wife screamed. She thought I was an intruder. She didn't recognize me.
I take it your daughter wasn't there when you arrived.
Ibrahim tore off a piece of the flatbread and pushed it around the rice for a moment.
She died that night in the torture chambers of Minya. She was raped to death by Mubarak's secret policemen. They buried her body in a criminal's grave on the edge of the desert and refused to let me even see it. For them, it was just another form of torture.
He sipped at his tea contemplatively.
My wife blamed me for Gian's death, It was her right, of course. If I hadn't joined the Sword of Allah, Jian would never have been taken. For many days, my wife refused even to look at me. A week later, I was informed by the university that my services were no longer needed. I was a broken man. I'd lost everything. My job, my daughter, my dignity. And so you decided to leave Egypt?
I had no choice. To remain would have meant living underground. I wanted to sever my ties with the sword. I wanted no part of jihadist politics. I wanted a new life in a place where men did not murder little girls in torture chambers.
Why Amsterdam?
My wife had family living in the Oud West. They told us that the Muslim community in Holland was growing, and that for the most part the Dutch were welcoming and tolerant. I applied for a visa at the Dutch embassy, and was granted one straight away.
I take it you neglected to inform the Dutch of your connection to the Sword of Allah?
It might have slipped my mind.
And the rest of the story you told me that night in Amsterdam?
It was all true. I built roads, then I swept them. I made furniture. He held up his ruined hand, even after I lost my fingers.
And you had no contact with other Sword members?
Most of those who fled Egypt settled in America or London. Occasionally one would blow through Amsterdam with the wind.
And when they did?
They tried to draw me back into the fight, of course. I told them I was no longer interested in Islamic politics. I told them I wanted to live an Islamic life on my own and leave matters of governance and state to others.
And the sword abided by your wishes?
Eventually, Ibrahim said. My son wasn't so accommodating, however.
It is because of your son that we're here tonight.
Ibrahim nodded.
A son who is half Egyptian and half Palestinian, a volatile mix.
Very volatile.
Tell me his name.
Ishak, the Egyptian said. My son's name is Ishak. It began with harmless questions. The kind of questions any curious adolescent boy might ask of his father. Why did we leave our home in Egypt to come to Europe? Why, if you were once a university professor, do you sweep streets? Why do we live in the land of strangers instead of the house of Islam? For many years I told him only lies. But when he was 15, I told him the truth.
You told him you were a member of the Sword of Allah?
I did.
You told him about your arrest and torture? About the death of Jian?
Ibrahim nodded. I hoped that by telling Ishak the truth, I would snuff out any jihadist embers that might be smoldering inside him. But my story had precisely the opposite effect. Ishak became more interested in Islamic politics, not less. It also turned him into an extremely angry young man. He began to hate. He hated the Egyptian regime and the Americans who supported it.
And he wanted revenge.
It is something you and the Americans never seem to fully comprehend about us, Ibrahim said. When we are wronged, we must seek revenge. It is in our culture, our bloodstream. Each time you kill or torture one of us, you are creating an extended family of enemies that is honor-bound to take retribution. Gabriel knew of this phenomenon better than most. He scooped up a bit of rice and beans with the bread and motioned Ibrahim to keep talking.
Ishak began to withdraw from Dutch society, he said.
He no longer maintained friendships with Dutch boys and started routinely referring to Dutch girls as temptresses and whores. He wore a kufi and jalabia. He listened only to Arabic music and stopped drinking beer. When he was 18, he was arrested for assaulting a homosexual man outside a bar in the Leedseplein. The charges were dropped after I went to the injured man and offered to make restitution.
Did he go to university?
Ibrahim nodded. At 19, he was accepted into the School of Information and Computer Sciences at Erasmus University in Rotterdam. I hoped that the demands of his studies would temper his Islamic fervor, but once he settled in Rotterdam, he became more Islamic in his outlook, not less. He fell in with a group of like-minded young jihadists. He traveled constantly to various marches and meetings. He grew his beard. It was as if my youth were being played out in front of me all over again.
He ate in silence for a moment.
I came to Europe to get away from Islamic politics. I wanted a new life, for myself and for my son. But by the mid-90s, radical Islamist politics had come to the West, and in many ways, it was more radical and toxic than the Islam of the Orient. It had been tainted by Saudi money and Saudi imams. It was Wahhabi and Salafist in its outlook. It was toxic and violent.
Was he involved in terrorist activities then?
Ibrahim shook his head. He was too confused to make a commitment to any one group or idea. He wasn't sure if he was an Egyptian or a Palestinian. One day, he was with the Friends of Hamas. The next, he was singing the praises of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan.
So what happened?
Osama bin Laden flew airplanes into buildings in New York and Washington, Ibrahim said, and everything changed.
Gabriel was not ready to relinquish the illusion of a waiting American airplane just yet, and so he summoned Sarah with two firm raps on the dining room door and murmured a few barely intelligible words into her ear about delaying its departure for a few minutes. Then he looked at Ibrahim and said,
"You were telling me about 9/11. Please continue." "It was an earthquake, a tear in the fabric of history, not only for the West, but for us."
"Muslims?"
"Islamists," he said, correcting Gabriel. "The Americans made a terrible miscalculation after 9/11. They saw Muslims dancing in the streets across the Arab world and in Europe, and therefore assumed that all Muslims and Islamists supported Osama. They lumped us all together with the global jihadists like bin Laden and Zawahiri. They didn't realize that for someone like me, a moderate Islamist, the attacks of 9/11 were just as unconscionable and barbaric as they were to the civilized world. We moderate Islamists believe that Osama and Al-Qaeda made a terrible tactical blunder by attacking the United States, and by picking a fight it could not possibly win. We believe that Osama was an Islamic charlatan who had done more to hurt the cause of Islamism than all the secular apostate regimes combined. What's more, we believe that the massacre of thousands of innocent people was a decidedly un-Islamic act that violated Islamic law and custom. The 19 hijackers were invited guests in America, and as such, they were honor-bound to behave accordingly. Instead, they slaughtered their hosts. Regardless of how you feel about us and our religion, we Muslims are hospitable people. We do not slaughter our hosts.
He pushed his plate toward Gabriel again. Gabriel took half a hard-boiled egg and a lump of feta.
I take it Ishak didn't see it that way.
No, he didn't, Ibrahim said. 9/11 pushed him to the edge of the precipice.
What pushed him over the edge?
Iraq.
Where was he recruited?
He was living in Amsterdam at the time with his wife, an Egyptian girl named Hanifa, and their son, Ahmed. Within days of the American invasion, he traveled to Egypt, where he made contact with the Sword of Allah. The Sword gave him elementary training in their clandestine schools and desert camps, then helped him travel to Iraq, where he trained and practiced his craft with Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. He left Iraq after 6 months and returned to Amsterdam, where he was in close contact with this man, Samir al-Masri. A month later, he moved his family to Copenhagen, where he took a job at something called the Islamic Affairs Council of Denmark. The council, I'm afraid, is nothing more than a front for jihadist activities.
Your son organized a second cell from Copenhagen?
So it would appear.
And so, when Samir and his cell vanished from Amsterdam a few days before the attack, you decided to approach me. You gave me just enough information in hopes of derailing the operation, so that your son might not be caught up in it.
Ibrahim gave a stoic nod of his head.
You lied to me, Gabriel said. You deceived me in order to save your son's life.
Any decent father would have done the same.
No, Ibrahim, not when innocent human lives are at stake. More than 300 people are dead because of you and your son. If you had told me the truth, the entire truth, we could have stopped the attack together. Instead, you gave me crumbs,
The same breadcrumbs you gave the SSI 25 years ago when you tried to save your daughter's life.
And if I'd told you more that night, where would I have ended up? The Americans would have assumed I was a terrorist. They would have placed me on a plane and shipped me back to Egypt to be tortured again.
Did you know London was the target? Did you know they were planning to kidnap Elizabeth Halton and ransom her for your friend, Sheikh Abdullah?
I knew nothing of their plans. These boys are extremely well trained. Someone highly skilled is pulling the strings.
Someone is. Gabriel hesitated.
Maybe that someone is you, Ibrahim. Maybe you're the one who masterminded the entire operation. Maybe you're the one they call the Sphinx.
The willingness to believe outlandish things is an Arab disease, Mr. Alan, not a Zionist one. The more time you waste pursuing silly notions like that, the less time we have to find the ambassador's daughter and bring her home alive.
Gabriel seized on a single word of Ibrahim's last answer, the word we. And how are we going to do that?
I believe Ishak is one of the terrorists holding the American woman hostage.
Gabriel leaned forward in his chair. Why would you think that?
Ishak left Copenhagen 2 weeks ago. He told Hanifa that he was going to the Middle East for a research trip on behalf of the Islamic Affairs Council. In order to maintain that fiction, he telephones the apartment every evening at Ahmed's bedtime.
How do you know?
Because Hanifa has told me so.
Have you spoken to him yourself?
I've left messages for him, but he never calls me.
Gabriel placed a notepad and pen on the table and slid them toward Ibrahim. I need the address of the apartment in Copenhagen, and I need the telephone number.
Hanifa and Ahmed have nothing to do with this.
Then they have nothing to fear.
I want you to promise me that no harm will come to them.
You're in no position to ask for anything, Ibrahim.
Promise me, Mr. Alan. Promise me you won't harm them.
Gabriel nodded once. Ibrahim wrote down the information, then pushed the pad toward Gabriel and recited two lines from the 22nd chapter of Genesis.
So early the next morning, Abraham saddled his ass and took with him two of his servants and his son, Isaac. He split the wood for the burnt offering, and he set out for the place of which God had told him.
You know your Hebrew scripture, said Gabriel. But he's no longer your son, Ibrahim. He's infected with the virus of jihad. He's a monster.
Perhaps. But he'll always be my son.
He looked down at the notepad in shame.
If I remember correctly, the Jews believe that Abraham went to Beersheba after passing God's test. But what will happen to me? Will I be shipped to Egypt for further questioning, or do I remain here?
He looked around the room. Wherever here is. I suppose that depends on the Americans. The disdainful look in Ibrahim's eyes made it clear how he felt about Americans.
I suggest leaving the Americans out of this, he said. It would be better for you and I to cross the bridge over Jahannam alone. Whatever you decide, do it quickly. The ambassador's daughter is in the hands of a young man whose sister was murdered by Pharaoh's henchmen. If he is ordered to kill her, he will not hesitate.
Chapter 28. Paris, 9:25 a.m., Tuesday. The interviewer from France 2 was shuffling his note cards, a sign that time was rapidly dwindling. Yusuf Ramadan, professor of Near Eastern History from the American University in Cairo, resident scholar at the Institute of Islamic Studies in Paris, and terror mastermind from the Sword of Allah, knew he would have to make his final point quickly.
And so I think the greatest danger of this crisis is not here in Europe, but in Egypt itself, he said in his faultless French. It is my understanding that the security services of the Egyptian regime have responded with a rather heavy hand, and if this behavior continues, it is likely to provoke a backlash that might very well threaten the stability of the regime itself.
The interviewer, intrigued by Ramadan's comment, ignored the instructions of the floor director to conclude the segment.
Are you accusing the government of Egypt of torture, Professor Ramadan?
The methods of Egyptian police and security services are well known, Ramadan said. You can be sure they are using torture and other unsavory methods in order to help the Americans find the ambassador's daughter.
Thought-provoking, as always, Professor Ramadan. I hope you'll join us again to help us analyze this ongoing crisis.
It would be my pleasure, said Ramadan, smiling warmly for the camera.
The interviewer informed the audience that France 2's coverage of the crisis would continue after a commercial break. Then he extended his hand toward Ramadan and thanked him privately for agreeing to appear on the program. Ramadan rose from his seat and was escorted off the set by a youthful female production assistant. 5 minutes later, he was climbing into a Citroën car waiting outside in the Esplanade Henri de France. He looked at his wristwatch. It was 9:25. The men and women of France 2 did not know it, but their morning was about to get a good deal more hectic. At that same moment in Zurich, a black Mercedes-Benz S600 sedan pulled sedately to the curb on the arrivals level of Kloten Airport. The man who emerged from the back seat looked a great deal like the vehicle itself, narrow at the head and a bit wide in the midsection for added stability. His suit was Italian, his overcoat cashmere, his leather suitcase large and expensive-looking. A Swiss policeman was standing watch at the entrance to the terminal with an automatic weapon across his chest. The well-dressed man nodded politely to him, then brushed past and went inside. He paused for a moment and gazed up at the departure board. The ticket in his breast pocket was for that morning's United Airlines flight to Dulles Airport. He had purchased the ticket despite the fact that he had no valid visa. It didn't matter. He wasn't planning to go to America, let alone board the airplane. He was a shaheed, a martyr, and the journey he was about to take had nothing to do with air travel. After determining the check-in counters for the flight, the shaheed set out across the glistening modern terminal, towing his suitcase behind him. It had undergone several modifications to suit his specific needs. The sides and wheels had been reinforced to accommodate a larger payload, and the button on the collapsible handle was a detonator. 12 pounds of pressure, the engineer had said. Just a little push. That's all it would take to start his journey. A civilian security agent was standing a few yards from the United Airlines check-in area, examining tickets and passports. Behind him, several dozen travelers, mostly Americans, were waiting in line. Because the Shaheed had no valid visa, he would be able to get no closer to his victims than the security agent. Their lives would not be spared, however. Along with 100 pounds of high explosive, the suitcase was packed with thousands of ball bearings and nails. The infidels standing in line would soon be reduced to ribbons of blood-soaked flesh. It would be a beautiful sight, thought the Shaheed. He only hoped that his soul might linger in the terminal for a moment after his death, so that he might see it. The security agent finished examining the travel documents of an American woman traveling with 2 young children, then motioned the Shaheed forward. He did as he was instructed, and handed the security man his ticket and passport.
Egyptian? The security agent asked with barely concealed suspicion.
Yes, that's correct.
You have a valid visa for travel to the United States today?
I was told I didn't need a visa.
By whom?
By Allah, he said.
The security agent reached for his radio. The Shaheed put his thumb on the detonator button. 12 pounds of pressure. Paradise. Though he did not know it, the Shaheed at Kloten Airport was not alone. 2 other suicide bombers had been dispatched to European airports that morning. One to Madrid's Barajas Airport, and another to Schwechat in Vienna. And all had been instructed to hit their detonators at the same instant. The martyr in Madrid was 1 minute late, but his comrade in Vienna did not explode his weapon until 9:35 Central European time. Investigators in Austria would later determine that the martyr, for reasons known only to himself, had stopped in an airport cafe for one last Viennese coffee before blasting himself to paradise. Yusuf Ramadan was made aware of the bombings at 9:38 while stuck in the mid-morning traffic along the Seine. It was not Abu Musa who broke the news to him,
but the production assistant from France 2, who, a few moments earlier, had escorted him from the building. It seemed that the station was planning extensive coverage of the terrorist attacks and was wondering whether Ramadan would consider spending the day as a paid consultant and commentator. He immediately agreed without bothering to ask the fee and, 10 minutes later, was taking his seat once more on the set.
Welcome back, Professor Ramadan. What do you think these latest attacks mean?
They mean that the United States had better open a channel of communication to the Sword of Allah soon, Ramadan said. Otherwise, I'm afraid a good deal more blood will be shed here in Europe.
Chapter 29. Copenhagen. 3:03 p.m. Tuesday. They decided a crash meeting was in order, and settled on Copenhagen's Airport Hilton Hotel as a suitable site. Adrian Carter arrived first, and was sitting in the lounge bar as Gabriel and Sarah strode into the lobby. He directed them toward the elevators with a weary glance, and a moment later they were huddled around the television in Carter's junior executive suite. Carter turned up the volume very loud. The room had been swept by CIA security, but Carter was a traditionalist when it came to matters of tradecraft, and, like Gabriel, regarded electronic gadgetry as a necessary but unfortunate corruption of a once noble art.
Zurich, Paris, Vienna, 3 airport attacks identical in design and perfectly coordinated.
Carter, staring at the images of carnage and destruction on the screen, shook his head slowly.
129 people confirmed dead, 500 injured, and Europe's air transport system in tatters.
And what about Europe's politicians? Asked Gabriel.
Publicly, they're saying all the right things, deplorable, barbaric, outrageous. Privately, they're pleading with us to make a deal with the devil. They're telling us to end this thing before more blood is shed on their soil. Even our close friend at Downing Street is beginning to wonder whether we should find some way of negotiating our way out of this. The Sphinx, whoever he might be, is a mass murderer and a ruthless bastard, but his timing is impeccable.
Any chance the president is going to bend?
Not after this. In fact, he's more determined than ever that this affair end without a negotiated settlement. That means we have no option but to find Elizabeth Halton before the deadline.
Carter's gaze moved from the screen to Gabriel.
And as of this moment, your Joe appears to be our best and only hope.
He's not my Joe, Adrian.
He is now, at least as far as official Washington is concerned.
Carter lowered the volume a decibel or two.
You caused quite a storm in Washington last night, Gabriel. Your interrogation with Ibrahim Fawaz is now required listening from Langley to the J. Edgar Hoover building to the National Security Council.
How were the reviews?
Mixed, said Carter. Expert opinion is divided over whether Ibrahim was being truthful or whether he was having you on for a second time. Expert opinion thinks you might have hitched your star to him too quickly. Expert opinion also fears you may have treated him far too gingerly.
What does expert opinion have in mind?
A second interrogation, said Carter.
Conducted by whom?
By agency men, with proper Christian names instead of an Israeli assassin.
So,
you're telling me that I'm being fired? That's exactly what I'm telling you.
You didn't have to come all the way to Copenhagen to fire me, Adrian. A secure phone call would have sufficed.
I felt I owed it to you. After all, I was the one who roped you into this.
How decent of you.
But tell me something, Adrian. Tell me exactly what your agency interrogators think they're going to get from Ibrahim that I didn't get from him.
Full and forthright answers, for starters.
Expert opinion believes he was being highly deceptive and evasive in his answers.
Oh, really?
Did they come up with this on their own, or did the computers do it for them?
It was a combination of the two, actually.
How much more forthright would you like Ibrahim to be?
He's agreed to help us find Elizabeth Halton, and he's given us the number of a telephone in Copenhagen that his son is calling every evening.
No, he's given us a number he says his son is calling.
And tonight, we'll find out whether he's telling the truth.
Higher authority isn't willing to wait that long. They want Ibrahim chained to a wall now.
Where do they think they're going to conduct this interrogation?
They were wondering whether they could borrow your facility in Germany.
That's not going to happen.
I was afraid you were going to say that. In that case, we have two other options. We could take him to one of our facilities in Eastern Europe.
Or we could put him on a plane to Egypt.
Gabriel shook his head slowly.
Ibrahim's not going to Eastern Europe, Adrian. And he's not going back to Cairo. No one's strapping him to any waterboards, and no one's chaining him to any more walls.
Now you're being unreasonable.
Carter looked at Sarah, as though she might be able to talk some sense into him.
Where exactly is Ibrahim at the moment?
Gabriel made no response. When Carter repeated the question, there was an edge to his voice that Gabriel had never heard before.
He's back in Amsterdam,
Gabriel said,
in his apartment in the August à la Beplein.
Why on earth did you send him back? We had no choice but to put him back,
Gabriel said.
If Ibrahim had vanished from the face of the earth, his wife would have called the Dutch police, and we both would have been faced with a Force 10 scandal in Holland.
Avoiding a scandal in Holland is not high on our list of priorities at the moment, Carter said.
We want him, and we want him now. I assume he's under watch?
No, Adrian, that slipped our mind.
Do try to control your fatalistic Israeli sense of humor for a few moments.
Of course he's under watch.
Then I assume you would have no trouble delivering him into our hands?
No trouble at all, Gabriel said.
But you can't have him.
Be reasonable, Gabriel.
I'm the only one who is being reasonable, Adrian. And if your goons go anywhere near him, they're going to get hurt.
Carter exhaled heavily.
It appears we have reached an impasse.
Yes, we have.
I suppose you have an alternative plan? Carter said.
I also suppose I have no choice but to listen to it.
My advice to you is to be patient, Adrian.
Elizabeth Halton dies at 6 o'clock Friday night. We don't have time to be patient.
I've given you the location and number of a telephone that one of her captors is calling on a regular basis. You have, in your arsenal, the National Security Agency, the largest and most sophisticated electronic intelligence service in the world. A service that is capable of vacuuming up every fax, phone call, and internet communication in the world, every second of the day. Give Ishak's number in Copenhagen to NSA, and tonight, when Ishak calls, tell NSA to bring all their considerable resources to bear on answering a single question. Where is he?
Carter stood up and ambled over to the minibar. He selected a soft drink, then, after consulting the price list, thought better of it.
To do this job right, you need to put a bug on the telephone in that apartment and a full-time surveillance team on Ishak's wife and son.
What do you think we've been doing all day, Adrian?
Watching movies in our hotel room?
Gabriel looked at Sarah.
You're the liaison officer, Sarah. Please give your superior an update on our activities today.
Hanifa and Ahmad Fawaz live in a section of Copenhagen called Norebro, Sarah said. Their apartment is located in a large turn-of-the-century block, almost a city within a city. Each apartment can be accessed by a front door and a rear service door. Late this morning, when Hanifa took Ahmed out for a stroll and some shopping, we slipped in the back door and put a...
She looked at Gabriel.
What was the device called that we put on their phone?
It's called a glass, said Gabriel.
It provides room coverage along with coverage of any conversations conducted over the telephone.
Christ! Carter said softly. Please tell me you didn't involve my officer in a B&E job in broad daylight in Copenhagen.
She's well trained, Adrian.
You would have been proud of her.
We also put a transmitter on the phone at the Islamic Affairs Council of Denmark, Sarah said. The junction box is located behind the offices in an alley. That one was easy.
You have them under visual surveillance too, I take it.
Gabriel frowned at Carter, as though he found the question mildly offensive. Carter looked down at the images of mayhem on the television screen.
I was sent here to fire you, and now I find myself volunteering for a suicide mission.
He shut off the television and looked at Gabriel.
All right, you win. We actually gave NSA the telephone number last night, assuming that Ishak is calling from a cell phone. NSA says it will take roughly 1 hour to pin down the approximate location. At that point, we'll notify the relevant local authorities and start looking.
Just make sure those relevant local authorities know that they'll kill her if anyone tries to rescue her.
We've already made it clear to our friends here in Europe that if there's any rescuing to be done, we intend to do it. In fact,
We've already moved 4 Delta Force teams into various European capitals for just this scenario. They're on hot standby. If we come up with hard intelligence on Elizabeth Halton's whereabouts, those Delta Forces will go in and get her, and we'll worry about assuaging hurt Euro feelings later. We have an entire division that deals with that sort of thing. Adrian, if you need any advice, just let us know.
You have enough to worry about.
Carter frowned and looked at his watch. You and your team are now responsible for physical surveillance of the wife and son here in Copenhagen. I'm going to London to explain why I disobeyed a direct order to terminate your involvement in this operation. The fate of Elizabeth Halton is in your hands, Gabriel, along with my career. Please, do your best not to drop us. Chapter 30. Torah Prison, Egypt. 4:19 p.m. Tuesday.
The Scorpion. Hell on Earth, thought Vizier Al-Zayat. 100 squalid cells containing the most dangerous Islamic radicals and jihadists in Egypt. 12 interrogation chambers where even the most hardened of Allah's holy warriors vomited their secrets after just a few hours of questioning at the hands of Egypt's secret police. Few who entered the Scorpion emerged with their souls or their body intact. Those who encountered Vizier Al-Zayat face to face rarely lived to talk about it. The Scorpion was more crowded that afternoon than it had been in many years. Al-Zayat did not find this particularly remarkable, since he was the man most responsible for the sudden surge of new arrivals. The prisoner, now under interrogation in Room 4, was among the most promising. Hussein Mandale, a middle school teacher from the Sword of Allah stronghold of Imbaba. He had been captured 12 hours earlier on suspicion of distributing a recorded sermon by Sheikh Tayeb Abdul Razak. That in itself was hardly a novel offense. The Sheikh's scorching sermons were the hip-hop of Egypt's downtrodden masses. But the content of the sermon found on Mandale was highly significant. In it, the Sheikh had made reference to the abduction of the American woman in London, and had called for a popular uprising against the regime, a set of circumstances that suggested the sermon had been recorded very recently. Al-Zayat knew the tapes did not appear by magic, or by the divine will of Allah. He was convinced that Hussein Mandale was the break he had been looking for. Al-Zayat pushed open the door and went inside. 3 interrogators were leaning against the gray walls, sleeves rolled up, faces glistening with sweat. Hussein Mandale was seated at the metal table, his face bloodied and swollen, his body covered with welts and burns. A good start, thought Al-Zayat, but not enough to break a boy from the slums of Imbaba. Al-Zayat sat down opposite Mandale and pressed the play button on the tape recorder resting in the center of the table. A moment later, the thin, reedy voice of Sheikh Taib was reverberating off the walls of the interrogation room. Al-Zayat allowed the sermon to go on for several minutes before finally reaching down and jabbing the stop button with his thick forefinger.
"Where did you get this tape?" he asked calmly.
"It was given to me by a man in a coffee house in Imbaba."
Al-Zayat sighed heavily and glanced at the 3 interrogators. The beating they administered was 20 minutes in duration and, even by Egyptian standards, savage in its intensity. Mandale, when he was returned to his seat at the interrogation table, was barely conscious and weeping like a child. Al-Zayat pressed the play button for a second time.
"Where did you get this tape?"
"From a man in..."
Al-Zayat quickly cut in.
"Yes, I remember, Hussein. You got it from a man in a coffee house in Imbaba. But what was this man's name?"
"He didn't tell me."
"Which coffee house?"
"I can't remember."
"You're sure, Hussein?"
"I'm sure."
Al-Zayat stood without another word and nodded to the interrogators. As he stepped into the corridor, he could hear Mandale begging for mercy.
"Do not fear the henchmen of Pharaoh,"
the Sheikh was telling him.
"Place your faith in Allah, and Allah will protect you."
Chapter 31. Copenhagen, 5:34 p.m., Tuesday.
There had been no time for housekeeping to acquire proper safe lodging for Gabriel's team in Copenhagen, and so they had settled instead at the Hotel d'Angleterre, a vast white luxury liner of a building looming over the sprawling King's New Square. Gabriel and Sarah arrived shortly after 5:30 and made their way to a room on the fourth floor. Mordecai was seated at the writing desk in stocking feet, headphones over his ears, eyes fixed on a pair of receivers like a doctor reading a brain scan for signs of life. Gabriel slipped on the spare set, then looked at Mordecai and grimaced.
"It sounds as though there's a pile driver in the room."
"There is," Mordecai said, "and his name is Ahmed. He's banging a toy against the floor a few inches from the phone."
"How long has it been going on?"
"An hour."
"Why doesn't she ask him to stop?"
"Maybe she's deaf. God knows I will be soon if he doesn't stop."
"Any activity on the line yet?"
"Just one outgoing call," Mordecai said. "She called Ibrahim in Amsterdam to complain about Ishak's prolonged absence. Unless it was an elaborate ruse, she doesn't know anything." Gabriel looked at his wristwatch. It was 5:37. A spy's life, he thought. Mind-numbing boredom broken by brief interludes of sheer terror. He slipped on the headset and waited for Hanifa's telephone to ring. They adopted the uncomfortable silence of strangers at a wake, and together endured an evening of frightening banality. Ahmed ramming his toy against the kitchen floor. Ahmed pretending to be a jet airplane. Ahmed kicking a ball against the wall of the sitting room. At 8:15, there was an ear-shattering crash. Though they were never able to accurately identify the object lost, it was of sufficient value to launch Hanifa into a hysterical tirade. A remorseful Ahmed responded by asking whether his father was going to telephone that night. Gabriel, who was pacing the floor as though looking for lost valuables, froze and awaited the answer. "He'll call if he can," Hanifa said. "He always does." Ibrahim, it seemed, had been telling the truth after all. At 8:20, Ahmed was ordered into a bath. Hanifa cleaned up the disaster in the sitting room, then switched on the television. Her choice of channels was illuminative, for it soon became clear she was watching Al-Manar, the official television network of Hezbollah. For the next 20 minutes, while Ahmed splashed about in his tub, they were forced to sit through a sermon by a Lebanese cleric who extolled the bravery of the Sword of Allah and called for more acts of terror against the infidel Americans and their Zionist allies. At 8:43, the sermon was interrupted by the shrill scream of the telephone. Hanifa answered it quickly, and in Arabic said, "Ishak, is that you?" It was not Ishak, but a very confused Danish man looking for someone named Knud. Hearing the voice of an Arabic-speaking woman, and, no doubt, the clerical rant in the background, he apologized profusely and hastily rang off. Hanifa returned the receiver to the cradle and shouted at Ahmed to get out of the bath. The Hezbollah preacher shouted back that the time had come for the Muslims of the world to finish the job Hitler had started. Mordecai looked at Gabriel in exasperation.
"Both of us don't have to sit through this shit," he said.
"Why don't you get out of here for a few minutes?"
"I don't want to miss his call."
"That's what the recorders are for." Mordecai handed Gabriel his coat and gave him a little shove toward the door.
"Go! Get something to eat, and take Sarah with you. You two make a nice couple."
A string quartet was sawing away indifferently at a Bach minuet downstairs in the parlor. Gabriel and Sarah slipped past them without a glance and struck out across the square toward the cafes along the new harbor. It had turned much colder. Sarah wore a beret, and her coat collar was turned up dramatically. When Gabriel teased her about looking too much like a spy, she seized his arm playfully and pressed her body against his shoulder. They sat outside along the quay and drank freezing Carlsberg beneath a hissing gas heater. Gabriel picked at a plate of fried cod and potatoes, while Sarah stared at the colorful, floodlit facades of the canal houses on the opposite embankment.
"Better than Langley, I suppose."
"Anything is better than Langley," he said. She looked up at the hard black sky.
"I suppose your fate is now in the hands of NSA and its satellites."
"Yours too," Gabriel said. "You would have been wise to go to London with Adrian."
"And miss this?"
She lowered her gaze toward the canal houses.
"If he calls tonight, do you think we'll be able to find her?"
It depends on how well NSA is able to pinpoint Ishak's location. Even if NSA does manage to locate Elizabeth, Washington is going to have another problem. How to get her out alive. Ishak and his colleagues are more than willing to die, which means that any attempt to storm the hideout will no doubt end violently. But I'm sure expert opinion will come up with a plan.
Don't play the wounded martyr, Gabriel. It doesn't suit you.
I didn't appreciate some of the things that were said about me in Washington today.
Washington is a town without pity.
So is Jerusalem.
Then you're going to need a thicker skin when you become the chief of the office.
She gave him a mischievous sideways glance over the top of her collar.
Adrian says it's just a rumor, but judging from your reaction, it's true.
She raised her glass.
Mazel tov.
This is the end of disc number 6. Please continue listening on disc number 7.